Hello, I'm Rupert Sheldrake, and I'm here with Mark Vernon.
Hi there,
Hello, Mark.
Rupert. Hi.
We meet irregularly and discuss subjects that interest us both. And our hope is that our discussions will help other people in their thinking and trigger off discussions elsewhere. And today, Mark, the topic I wanted to talk about is panpsychism. Panpsychism is the idea that there's a kind of mind or psyche everywhere. Pan means everywhere, psyche means soul or mind. And panpsychism used to be a doctrine more or less taken for granted under the name of animism. In the Middle Ages in Europe, the official philosophy in the universities and in the monasteries was largely shaped by St. Thomas Aquinas, based on Aristotle, the idea that all living things have a soul. The earth has a soul, the stars have souls, all animals and plants have souls. The fact that animals are called animals is from the Latin word soul. It's a view that's taken for granted in shamanic societies, in most religious cultures. It's almost universal. And the major exception has been in the West since the 17th century with the mechanistic theory of nature. Nature is a machine, animals and plants are machines, our bodies are machines. And so the spirit or the psyche was drained out of all nature, especially in the philosophy of Descartes, which has had such an enormous influence. But what's so interesting at the moment is that there's a large-scale revival of panpsychism going on within philosophy of mind and within neuroscience. And the main reason for this within the academic world is the so-called hard problem of consciousness. If, as materialism says, everything in nature is unconscious, everything's made of matter and matter's unconscious, how come we're conscious? We ought not to be. So, one of the motives for modern panpsychism is actually, paradoxically, to preserve materialism by attributing to matter psychic powers. And then by saying there's a limited level of psychic ability or experience is the better word, even in electrons or atoms. And therefore, the emergence of consciousness in humans is not a difference in kind, but a difference in degree. And I would call this conservative panpsychism or materialist panpsychism, because the motive is to explain consciousness without upsetting the apple cart of materialism. And some panpsychists, like Kamala Harris and Galen Strawson, actually reassure their readers that this won't make the slightest difference. It just gets rid of the hard problem, but leaves science as we know it more or less intact and untouched. However, there are more radical kinds of panpsychism, and those I think are motivated by the feeling or recognition that we live in a living world. Nature is indeed alive. There are many forms of intelligence in the world besides human intelligence. Shamanic societies recognize all sorts of animating principles in nature to which humans can relate. And that's a very different kind of panpsychism or animism. And that can lead to pantheism, the idea the whole conscious universe is conscious, and that's the ultimate reality. Or it can be put within a larger framework of panentheism, the idea that God is in nature and nature's in God. So it's sort of intermediate between limited panpsychism and kind of panentheism. So panpsychism actually has a fairly wide spectrum of possibilities, and that's what I wanted to discuss with you today, Mark.
Yeah, well, thank you for laying it out because it's very helpful to try and hold in mind what these terms mean and how the same term can mean actually quite different things in different contexts as well. And As you spoke, it reminded me, actually, I've been reading a little bit about early modern science and the ideas that shaped early modern science coming out of the Reformation in particular. And I think this kind of tells a bit of a story that maybe helps to put materialism and then this conservative panpsychism in a kind of narrative context. Because I think one of the things that happened was that figures like Descartes, who you mentioned, were very influenced by Reformation thinkers who became very keen to preserve the transcendence of the monotheistic divinity in Christianity, of God, and to preserve it from what had been another part of the assumption in the medieval world, which was more panentheistic, that the divine participated in the natural world, in human minds, and showed up, as it were, in all sorts of ways throughout creation. And this was severely attacked at the Reformation, partly because figures like Luther and Calvin became very suspicious of the fallen world in a way that hadn't really fully taken off in the medieval world. So Calvin talks about the mind being depraved, and Luther seems to have been deeply troubled by aspects of his own consciousness. And so had this effect of kind of splitting the created order from the creator. And then that gets then taken up, that split, in figures like Descartes, who split matter from mind, you know, with the broad intuition that mind must be more divine, matter must be more created. And so you've got to kind of hold them apart because of these Reformation fears, really, about the fallen world. But then that leads to the problem, of course, of how you put them back together again. So in a strange sort of way, materialism is part of the religious story stemming out of this Reformation impulse to preserve God. But of course, if you sort of cut God off too much in the effort to preserve God's purity, it then becomes quite easy just to drop God altogether, particularly then when the mechanistic side of things kicks in, as you were describing, that purports to explain everything. Well, what need have I of this hypothesis, as Lepanche eventually put it? You can just, it seems, drop God altogether, but for this niggle that consciousness is our most direct experience. It's how we can even propose there might be such a thing as matter, because no one directly experiences matter. You directly experience your experience. So matter is a kind of inference. And I think my sense then is that panpsychism, in the conservative sense, as you're putting it, in a way is the beginnings of a sort of reductio ad absurdum of this split between mind and matter. Because in a way, what the conservative panpsychism does is just try to push it to the lowest possible level, you know, so the atoms themselves are somehow have, as you say, these psychic powers, or maybe two aspects, two kinds of properties. But the mind body split is still there. The mind matter split is still there. It's just, as it were, almost vanishingly small, until you take a look and realize, well, actually, it still is there, and really nothing has changed. Which, in a strange sort of way, is perhaps why someone like Galen Strawson can say, well, actually, it doesn't really change anything, because it doesn't actually solve the hard problem at all. For all that, you know, quite brilliant people now are trying to make it stack up in that way.
Yes, that's a very interesting way putting it. And actually, I think, you know, one of the main materialist ways of explaining consciousness is epiphenomenalism. The activity of the brain somehow creates consciousness as a kind of byproduct, but the consciousness doesn't do anything. And actually, I think the conservative panpsychism is kind of epiphenomenalism all the way down. You know, so you've got epiphenomenal consciousness, which doesn't do anything. Just say it's there, you can admit it's there because it doesn't do anything, even in electrons or atoms. So I think the challenge for those of us who think we need to go beyond conservative panpsychism is to say what this mind or experience actually does do in atoms or molecules or crystals or cells, or in the rest of nature. And one of my own attempts to try and move this argument forward is, as you know, we've discussed this before, is think about the consciousness of the sun. Because if all things, all self-organizing systems in nature have some kind of mind or experience, then it should apply not just to atoms and electrons, but to the sun, the whole solar system, the galaxy, and indeed the cosmos as a whole. And so what difference would it make to think of the sun as conscious? Well, from the point of view of conservative panpsychism, no difference at all, because its consciousness would just be an epiphenomenon of the physical processes that go on in the sun already described by physics. But if it does make a difference, then it would mean that the sun had the ability to choose and to decide and actually to control to some degree what's happening in the solar system. It might decide when to shoot off solar flares. It might decide when to blast planets with coronal mass ejections. And if it did that to us, all our electricity power systems would go out, and so would satellite systems. And at least for a period of months, civilization as we know it would stop. It wouldn't be just like the lockdown where we still have the internet and Zoom. We wouldn't have the internet and Zoom. That's one way in which I think we could begin to see a panpsychism that makes a difference rather than a panpsychism that doesn't make a difference. Another way is to think about what the experience of an atom might be like, or an electron. And experience is about feelings. It's not primarily about intellectual thoughts. And what kind of feelings does an electron have? Well, it has quite strong feelings of attraction towards positive charges in atomic nuclei or in an electrical circuit. Electrons whiz along as electric currents. They're whizzing through our computers right now. As they whiz along, they're attracted towards positive charges. They're repelled from negative charges. So attraction and repulsion are the very words we use for electric phenomena and for magnetic phenomena. And we just assume the attraction and repulsion are unconscious or non-conscious. But there's an obvious starting point for attributing feeling to electrons and protons, and indeed magnets. They do experience feelings. They're drawn towards one thing or repelled from another. And a lot of our own behavior, after all, depends on attraction and repulsion. We're attracted to certain people or certain foods or certain activities. We're repelled from others. And these are actually powerful motives for our behavior. We don't start with intellectual ideas which are totally neutral emotionally. We start with emotions. From the very moment we're born, and maybe before we're born, the intellectual ideas are a kind of froth on top of all that. I don't yet know how thinking in terms of attraction and repulsion at the electron or atomic or crystalline or molecular level would lead to testable predictions, but hopefully sooner or later it could.
Yeah, see, I wonder whether this, again, is kind of part of a direction of travel. Because when you talk about that, and I know you know about this as well, it takes me to A.N. Whitehead and his idea that what we call matter, including our brains, is actually part of the process by which we come to know consciousness in the way that we do. But that actually underpinning it all is the complete reversal in a way, which is a form of idealism, which is to say that consciousness itself is the basic stuff. And it's out of that, that what we call matter, and then these various features of matter, from the attraction or repulsion of electrons through to ourselves as feeling, we're subjects and objects with these kind of feelings. It's out of the aboriginal consciousness that these qualities emerge, but they still have a part to play because they shape and form our experience of consciousness. So, you know, sometimes it's talked about in relation to the brain, that the brain is not the generator of consciousness. It's also not just a kind of passive receiver of consciousness, but it helps to forge and make consciousness. And particularly, for example, the experience of time would come out of the interaction between what we call matter, which Whitehead conceives instead as kind of events or processes that are in the present, because there's only the present, but that have a sort of foot in the past and a step into the future. And so that picture of reality, certainly as we experience it, starts to bring about the experiences that we actually have. And another thought, you see, I think part of the reason why I feel that this is a kind of step towards the return of some kind of idealism is that it feels like in the panpsychist world, even in the more sophisticated ways you're talking about, is that things like the attraction and repulsion of electrons, we talk about that of electrons by analogy from our own experience. We, as it were, project it onto the electrons, which I guess is how these words originally arise. And I think that's going to be unstable. It's not really going to tell us how electrons are in themselves. You get this a lot, I feel, in what is another kind of parallel, quite dominant alternative to panpsychism now in the physics world, which is draws on information theory. And it'd be the idea that matter carries information. And then the physicists will tell you very quickly that that's not information in the sense that you or I mean it. Because, you know, when we have an exchange of information, kind of like now talking, you have to have a receiver of that information that knows about the meaning of the pure sound. And so kind of interpret the information. And that, of course, requires consciousness. What they'd say is that there's a kind of aboriginal information, which is just purely about the bits and bytes of the data being there, that kind of lock together in a kind of machine sort of way, a bit like cogs in a clock. You might say there's information in the cogs in a clock, but you don't have to have anyone that understands the cogs in the clock in order for the cogs in the clock to work. But I feel that this is already using the word information and understanding, say, the basic units of reality in the materialist frame, like atoms and photons and electrons and so on, as them carrying information, is already to project something that we experience all day, every day, onto the world of the very small, as if that's going to explain something. It might produce useful models for understanding and making predictions about the way the world works. And sure enough, it does. I mean, information theory is very, very powerful in that way. But somehow to use information as a replacement for either just straightforward mechanical materialism or, on the other hand, a kind of idealism, and feels to me like it's not gonna stand up for long, actually. You know, one generation of physicists will put it across as they are now, but the next generation will start to question where it doesn't quite add up. And so there'll be a continuous process of unfolding. And my guess would be towards some kind of idealism again.
Yes. Well, personally, I have a problem with idealism in many of its formulations because of its, and indeed with physics in many of its formulations, because the way that time is downgraded into a spatial dimension. And actually, that's one of the main points in Whitehead, who you mentioned, and Bergson, who came before him, in the philosophy of taking time as real, process as real. And so I think what we actually see in the constitution of matter and in the constitution of mind is, and indeed in the formulation of the Holy Trinity, which we've discussed, the idea of the supreme divine consciousness, is a time or process principle and a more spatial form principle. And we see that even in the clockwork analogy, in the clockwork that gave rise to the 17th century vision of the universe as clockwork. You've got the cogs all moving together, but the driving force of that is the weight. You have to wind the clock up. And there's this weight pulled by gravity, which is actually the driving force of the whole thing. And remove the driving force of gravity and you've just got a clock that's run down, that doesn't move. And I think that the driving force, it's interesting that there's a kind of underlying process of time in the whole universe, which drives the entire universe. And there's an attractive force in the future, which actually I'm thinking more and more of as gravity. Gravity pulls. It pulls you and me now. That's why we're not floating. It pulls the whole universe. Left to its own devices, it would pull everything in the universe together until it all ended in the opposite of the Big Bang, the Big Crunch. The ultimate attractor, for gravity would be everything coming together in an ultimate unity, pulling the whole of time towards that ultimate unity. And in fact, until about 2000, most physicists thought the universe was going to stop expanding and start contracting and end up in a gigantic, or no doubt smaller and smaller, black hole as everything was pulled together into an ultimate unity. So gravity is like a pull from the future. And when people represent attractors in physical models, you know, you have a potential well, you have something like that, and the chemical reaction is represented by a ball, and it goes down to the minimum energy at the bottom of the potential well. The actual model there is gravitational pull as the basis of attraction. The universe started, we're told, with a Big Bang, which was a push, of outflow of energy. So there's a sense in which energy is pushed from behind and pulled from the future. And the process involves past and future as it moves through the present. And regular physics is largely based on pushes from the past, billiard ball physics, momentum from the past, causation from the past. But as Whitehead recognized, there's also a kind of pull from the future, an attractor. And I think that flow is associated, even in physical processes, with spatial patterns. If an electric current flows along a wire, it creates a spatial magnetic field around it. It's represented in a kind of spatial form. As electricity flows through our brains, as it does, it creates spatial forms and images, like I can see you now. It's a spatial form. My perception, my visual perception, is all spatial forms. Most of our ideas have spatial aspects. What we recognize around us, trees, plants, flowers, other people, computers, machines, are spatial forms. But there seems to me this twofold aspect of a moving principle, which we represent as energy or process or change, and a spatial principle. And in the ultimate model of consciousness in the Holy Trinity, there's a ground of all things, but then, as we've discussed before, there's the moving principle, the spirit, and there's the formative principle, the logos, which is about this creation of form. I suppose the trouble I have with idealism is that because it tends to be based on the idea that there's a consciousness beyond space and time, which is the way we experience consciousness in some kinds of mystical states or sometimes in meditation, the idea of going beyond space or time abstracts consciousness from time, whereas that seems to be a vital part of reality, both conscious reality and physical reality.
Yeah, I mean, it's very fascinating to sort of try and push it to the edges, both of our experience and our imaginations. And to pick up on what you're saying, and my kind of caution, which would push me back to an older form of idealism, which, as you say, would see a kind of ground of being out of which consciousness emerges, and then time and space and so on emerge as well. Or actually, I should say rather emanate, because I'm not very keen on the word emergence, because it seems to me that the word emergence is a kind of something out of nothing concept. You know, it wasn't there before and it is there now. So you have to have a full sense of all potential is held in your ground of being. And then they manifest, as it were, in beings themselves. That's slightly side issue, but I prefer the word emanation for now. But the bigger point, to go back to what you're saying, well, put it like this. You see, it's very interesting about clocks and gravity driving things, and the way you put it like that, because when gravity came to mean what it does now, it was cut off from what was felt to be its equal and opposite force in the medieval world again, which was levity. And gravity was the force that, as it were, drew you down, and levity was the force that drew you up. But of course, they were as much spiritual dynamics as they were physical. There wasn't really the separation between the two. So the spiritual levity was associated with, say, air and fire that tended to rise, that tended to return to the divine, whereas gravity was associated with water and earth that tended to go down and separate you from the divine. But in a kind of chain of being, not in any absolute dualistic sense. And so my feeling is that when you introduce a kind of vertical element into this picture, as well as a horizontal one of space and time, in other words, sort of bringing back the levity alongside the gravity, then maybe this makes for a kind of idealism that sees eternity as the kind of container or holder of then all this multiplicity that emerges in our experience as we have it. I said emerge again, emanates in our experience as we know it now, rather than abstracting consciousness from the picture, this kind of ground of being, this pure consciousness from the picture. It is the cosmos within which all this other stuff shows up that we talk about. And I think this is broadly Plato's original idea. It's not as Platonism is often meant now, which we've talked about before as well. But Plato's original thought was that time is the moving image of eternity. And so it's a bit like a light that gets sparkles into a thousand or a million pieces if it catches a thousand or million refracted mirror. We, as it were, directly experience the refractions, the reflections of the mirror. But we can also know that any particular reflection which we directly experience in our seemingly separate person is still the true light, which comes from the one light, like the consciousness that contains all things. And so time, therefore, is the moving image of eternity, but it's still eternity. It's just eternity in one particular emanation or experience of eternity, rather than being separate from eternity. And I think that helps me to understand these experiences which you mentioned, that actually I think is quite a common experience in psychotherapy too, that you feel time taking on different forms as you go into more effectively meditative states in therapy, and even feel at times that you touch the timeless. It's not that you're not there, you are there, but you just feel as if you're in the presence of the whole thing rather than just one particular take on it. So it's that, it would be that kind of idealism that I would prefer to move towards, that doesn't split consciousness out for sure, but that would seem to be a pointless exercise actually, but sees time and space and so on being the kind of activities of consciousness viewed from a particular point of view.
Yes. I think the, I suppose the reason I'm not so keen on emanation, I'm not keen on emergence for the same reasons you're not, but emanation implies an outward movement in space. Of course, in time as well, because it's a process, but it can sometimes be interpreted as in some forms of Plato's vision in the Timaeus, where he talks about this as something that happened then, not now, in the beginning, an emanation that created the world through then a demiurge shaped it and so on. I think that if it's an emanation that's going on now, the eternity is the ground of the process that's still happening now. And these are deep philosophical and theological issues, because within the Christian doctrine of the Holy Trinity, one of the formulae for this is consubstantial, co-eternal. The three aspects of ultimate reality, the ground of being, the energy or movement or flow of the spirit, and the formation of the logos, the words, forms, shapes, patterns, connections, meanings, are all eternal. It's not that in the beginning there was the God the Father, and then by an emanation the other two parts of the Holy Trinity came along, which is the vision that some idealisms would suggest. Rather, they've all been there all along, all together. And so the sense in which this flow in time, the flow of the spirit, this unpredictable flow of the spirit, which is both pushed from the past and pulled from the future, is an eternal process. And it's interesting you see that in modern cosmologies, one vision is the contracting universe, the Big Crunch model. The universe expands up to a certain point and then begins to contract, and it all ends in blackness, a kind of dark hole, black hole, the Big Crunch. The other model is that it expands faster and faster and faster until all matter evaporates into light, and we're just left with a universe with nothing but light, which is itself process. Light moves at the speed of light by definition. It is the ultimate process. Now, Roger Penrose has advocated that model. And then, of course, there are people who say, well, it just goes, it bounces. It goes small, and then goes big, and then goes small again. And you get a bouncing universe, a cyclic universe model. But the fact is that where we are now is somewhere where both these processes are in some kind of balance. There's both an outward movement and expansion of the universe, and there's the contractive force of gravitation. There's both the push and the pull going on together. And one comes from the past, the outward push of the universe, the expansion. The Big Bang implies a kind of explosion and outward movement. And then dark energy is supposed to go on pushing it further out. And the other is this contractive effect. And even if you look at, I've been thinking about the most elementary sort of mechanical movements, models of movement, like ballistics. As in 17th century physics, you fire a cannonball up into the air and it goes sort of up, and then it sort of goes on a trajectory and then comes down again. There you've got the push from the past, the firing the gunpowder that pushes the cannonball up. And you've got the pull from the future, which pulls it down to Earth again. And the cannonball, even as such a simple mechanical system as a cannonball going up in its trajectory, is both pulled from the past and pushed from the past and pulled from the future. And that way of thinking about time seems to me as a kind of eternal principle, not something that has to be added on after a beginning, but somehow the nature of reality is that all these things are happening together. There's this consciousness which has this eternal sort of beyond time aspect, but yet within time and informational form are all part of the same thing. I think that's why I'm attracted more by the Christian model of the Holy Trinity than pure idealist philosophies, which want to get rid of time ultimately and go beyond it altogether. I don't think we can, at least we can, but only at the expense of abstracting. And this is, after all, a live debate today. There are idealists like Bernardo Kastrup, who put a very convincing case, or Rupert Spira, for the primacy of consciousness. And we've also got, as we started by discussing, you know, the sort of conservative panpsychists who basically want the materialist model to continue without too much disruption, just adding on consciousness is sort of tacking it on as an extra principle to solve the problem, the hard problem. And that seems to, we've got this full spectrum of debate going on today. And actually, it hasn't really been debated that much for decades. Whitehead and Bergson both tried to start a debate about the reality of process and time. But I think we're actually entering a historically interesting moment at the moment where all these possibilities are on the table.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with you there that it's very exciting that all these things can be, you can find good advocates, as it were, of all positions and then contemplate them yourselves. I mean, just to put my last maybe throw back to your comments there about, say the cannonball, because it seems to me that you're right, there is one way of looking at it, which is the push from the past and the pull from the future. But that parabolic curve could be described by a mathematical equation, which would, as it were, capture both the past, the present, and the future in one expression. Now, that alone is an abstraction, and I hear your comment there on that. But I think that maths itself, and I think this is going back to Plato originally, he didn't think of mathematics in the abstract way that people tend to think of it now. He thought of it in terms of living intelligences. And this then gets picked up particularly in the angelology that comes out of Neoplatonism and the medieval period. So you're actually, you don't stop with the abstraction, you stop with the living organism, as it were, of the cosmos as a whole. And then when you get to the higher angels, the cherubim and the seraphim, the kind of pure intelligences, the pure light. And for me, that is an image of plenitude, not of abstraction. And the mistake that so-called Platonism, as it's come to mean now, as if mathematics and forms are somehow what Plato had in mind, I think that's a mistake. I do agree with you on that. If it feels like it's just becoming a kind of abstraction, then you're not headed in the right direction. But when you see it just as different takes on these things, depending upon your point of view, from the eternal perspective down to, as it were, the person watching the cannonball fly through the sky, given you can see it move, you know, then the whole thing can be embraced. And so, you know, I think Bernardo Kastrop even has started talking about angels, because I think he's realizing that you need this kind of living, felt quality of intelligence within what in the Christian world would be called the kind of divine plenitude. And you know, it is in Christianity as well as the Trinity. In certain parts of Christianity, like Meister Eckhart, he would talk about the ground as well, das Grund, the kind of Godhead, which does take we creatures to a horizon which we perhaps can't look over. But then maybe we should only expect that as mortal creatures after all, even if we share in the ground of being that is the divine ground too, certainly this side of eternity.
Well, that seems a good note on which to end, Mark. I'm sure we'll have a lot more to say about these questions, but I think it's a wonderful way of giving a complete picture, or at least pointing towards a complete picture, and one that includes all sorts of elements that are certainly left out of the shadow of forms of panpsychism today, and opens up this whole question and for ongoing discussion. I mean, we're still discussing it now, long after Plato's discussion, and these are still living questions for us today, more living than they would have been, say, 100 years ago.
Yeah, and as we were saying, you can do a quick search for YouTube, find the figures who are the good, best advocates of different positions. I mean, you mentioned Bernardo Kastrop, and Philip Goff is a quite good advocate, I think, of conservative panpsychism. Someone like Tim Freake would be somewhere in the middle. I think Rupert Spira is a good advocate of coming from a more Sufi or Vedantic tradition. And I don't know, someone like David Bentley Hart, actually, his next book, which I've just seen an early version of, he's going to have a lot about how this all fits together, particularly from an Eastern Christian point of view, which is more, I think, open to ideas of Godhead than perhaps Western Christianity has been. But there are very articulate advocates of all these positions. So go and have a search, listener, if you're interested in these things and want to take an even deeper dive. But thanks very much, Rupert. That's really fascinating.
Thank you, Mark.